Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or, as they want to call it, bisexual man. If you have any comments you would like to make during this podcast, you can email them to me at bonk@aol.com. That's bonk@aol.com. So before I introduce my special guest for tonight, I would like to mention a couple of things. We're going to put together a new book. It's called Letters to My, Gay Ex-Husband. And it's a chance to, kind of start healing from the process. But we're doing it so that people can understand the difficulties and the hardships that we as straight wives go through. It just seems that, it's just so common now that when a man comes out of a marriage and that he comes out that he's gay, that everybody tells him, oh, how proud they are of him and, congratulating him for finding his authentic self. Which is fine, but not at the expense of the woman he dragged along for 10, 20, 30, 40 years and the children who got really, torn between in this marriage. So there's a lot of issues that people never understand about straight wives. And if you would like to participate in this and like to write a letter for the book, just write to me at bonkay@aol.com. That's bonkaye@aol.com. I just wanted to mention next Sunday night I have a very special guest who hasn't been with us for a while. But if you've been part of this network, then you certainly know her name, Donna Anderson. Donna Anderson is the head of lovefraud.com, which is a wonderful information site for fraudulent marriages, for narcissists, sociopath. Donna's really the expert on that. So please, you know, tune in next week. So tonight, I'm going to welcome one of our newer support group members. She's been with us for a number of months, and her name is Janae. Janae, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Janae, you haven't been with us that long, but you're an integral part of this group, you know, more so than many others, because you're actively always participating. Plus, you have a background of doing counseling for women who are in abusive situations and only to find yourself in the same situation. So let me start you off with whatever you want to start off with.
Well, I don't have a degree in counseling. What my degree is I'm an RN, and I've worked a lot in various fields. That's one of the nice things about being an RN is there's so many fields open to you. I've worked in pediatrics, OBGYN. I've worked in ICU, ER, a little in labor and delivery. I've worked in home health. And the job I loved the most, aside from ICU, was I was the day treatment center charge nurse for a psychiatric adolescent center for children. My specialty kind of came about because of my own personal experience. A lot of times in life, that's the best knowledge you can have. You can't get it from a book because it's the feelings, it's the experience that you just don't read in a textbook. But I found my niche working with children, helping them through sexual abuse. And that's kind of where my expertise lay with children. I mean, we had children with all sorts of issues in our psychiatric treatment center, but I was pretty much the go-to person that dealt with that with our kids.
Okay.
Some of my own history. Oh, go ahead.
Yes, I was going to ask you about your own history, how it, you know, kind of fell into this was not just exactly an accident, right?
No. I had a really horrific childhood. And my mother always said that I was grown up when I was born, but I didn't come by that lightly. I was more or less forced into that caretaking role. I used my own experience. I could relate to the kids. One of the greatest compliments I think I've ever received in my nursing career was I've worked with a lot of different psychiatrists. And he told me one day, he said, Sonia, you really have this ability to relate to children. And I, you know, never went into it with him about my history, but I thought to myself, it's not a gift. Or maybe it is, I don't know, it's just from experience. I know I can't sing and I can't draw, so goodness gracious, the good Lord gave me something that I could work with. And being able to take a poor child that's been traumatized and they shut down from horrific abuse of any kind, especially sexual abuse, and be able to bring out hope and help them understand that it's not their fault, because children have a lot of sense of shame and guilt. They feel like they must have caused this or had done something to have brought this on. They feel like they're inherently evil and bad and ugly. And, of course, it's never a child's fault if they are subjected to any kind of abuse. It's always the adults. And to be able to, you know, take a child that's been so broken and try to mend them and put them back together is one of the greatest things that I've ever been able to accomplish in my nursing career.
So
I wanted
you
to
also
give a
have,
little.
Yeah, I want to give you a little bit of background on your family life when you were growing up.
Right. My mother was very young when she got married. Oftentimes you'll find these dysfunctions in families. If you do histories and backgrounds, you'll find that there's been histories of sexual abuse, drug abuse, alcoholism, mental illness, all these different things. And a lot of times as nurses, what we'll have to do is we have to do an extensive history on our patients. And part of that is going back through the family. You interview the family members, you talk to the children or whomever your client is, and you try to get a detailed history. And you put all this down, and you work hand-in-hand with the psychiatrist in order to be able to find out what the core problems are in the family with their dynamics, how this is affecting the child, and what the best course of treatment is. So you have to do a very detailed physical and mental evaluation of your client. And with myself, a little history on me is my mother was sexually abused when she was a little girl. Her mother had married a man, and she had three children with him. And then they divorced, and she married another man who was my mother's stepfather, and he sexually abused her when she was a little girl. So he also sexually abused her little sister. There was my mother, she had a little sister, and then she had a little brother. And her little sister was, probably 6 years younger than her, I believe. But anyway, my mom was abused by her stepfather, and nothing was ever done about it. My grandmother stayed with him. In fact, after my mother passed away about 7 years ago, and after she passed away, I got in contact with my aunt, and my aunt told me that when she was sexually abused, she actually went to my grandmother and told my grandmother what was going on. And my grandmother's response to her was, well, you know, I need him because he financially supports me. So what do you want me to do about it? And my mother's little sister ended up getting pregnant by my grandfather's brother, who was my aunt's uncle, when she was about 12 years old. And she had the baby when she was 13, and she was forced to give it up for adoption. So that's a little bit on my mother's sister. Now, with my mother was kind of rebellious, didn't want to go to school. You know, I'm sure she had a lot of anger issues and things like this. So when she was 13 years old, she ran off with a truck driver. And she talked my grandparents into going ahead and signing for her to get married to this man. And she was only married to him a short period of time. And then she took off and left him. And then she went back to the house where my grandmother and this abusive stepfather was. And my mom was miserable there. She worked and lied about her age in bars because that was about the only job she could get, because her stepfather told her, well, if you're going to stay here, you have to, you know, contribute to the household. So she lied about her age. This was, you know, years ago, and she was working in a bar, you know, serving drinks underage. So she did that until she met my stepfather. And she married him. She married my dad. She married my father when she was 15 years old. And then she was married to my father until I was about 2 years old. And they got a divorce because my father had been in the Korean War. And when he came back from the war, he was an alcoholic. And he was extremely abusive when he drank. He would just beat you up. He'd go crazy. My mom told me stories throughout my childhood of different events that occurred in her life. And she said that my father was insanely jealous. And my father decided he thought she was having an affair with the next door neighbor. They were living in California. And he beat her up, chased her around, threatened her with a knife. And she said she took me and left. And she went back to where my grandmother and her stepfather lived with me as a tiny baby. And then she said my father came down there when she was at work, she's got another job working in a bar, I believe. But my father came down there and wanted to see me, and my grandmother went into the kitchen while my father was there, and he stole me and took me back to his parents' house. They lived in Kansas. And my mom said she ended up getting in the car and driving up to Kansas and demanding to get me back. And she said my father threatened her that he was going to put my eyes out with a cigarette.
Wow.
People were insane. I'm telling you, Bonnie, it was crazy. But anyway, mm-hmm. So my mother got me back, and she went back to her mother and stepfather's house. And then there was an Air Force base there in Amarillo. And this man that was in the Air Force, he met my mom. I'm assuming they met out in Amarillo because she was working out in a bar. And they ended up dating, and then they got married, and I was about 2 years old. And so I was so young, I had no concept of having a father, a biological father, prior to this man. And my mother always made me believe that this man was my biological father. I found out years later by accident, but what happened was he ended up traveling a lot because he was in the military, so we lived various places. You know, they would move sometimes, several times a year, to different houses, and so everything was really chaotic. There was no stability, and he was an alcoholic. So they, you know, drank and partied a lot, and my mom was very unstable. She was very abusive. She was really angry at me because she had me so young. She was 15 when she got married, and she had me at 16. And my mother never bonded with me because she didn't really want me. She felt I was an inconvenience. I mean, she told me that I ruined her life. And one time she even said to me, well, you know, if they'd had abortions back then, you would have been sucked up in a vacuum cleaner. And I thought, at the time, I was so little, I was probably 6 or 7. I thought, what a horrible thing for a mother to tell her child.
Really?
Even at that age, I think I had better sense, you know. But anyway, she just told me that I ruined her life. That, you know, things would have been so much better. Her and my father could have had a better marriage. All that. My mom just felt like I ended her life. So she kept me, and I asked her. I said, Mom, because it was very obvious she beat me up. She kicked me, hit me, was constantly criticizing me, humiliating me, cussing me out, you know, telling me I was ugly, worthless, I was stupid, I'd never amount to anything, she wished she'd never had me. And so I said one time to her, I said, Mom, why in God's name didn't you go ahead and just give me away or adopt me out? And her answer to me at the time, even as a child, I thought, that's very narcissistic. And that's when I started realizing this woman had mental issues. I was always trying to figure out why she was so cruel and mean to me. What was wrong? What had I done? So she said to me, well, she said, what do you think I am? Some kind of dog that just leaves her puppies scattered all over? She said, besides, if I had given you away or did something like that, everybody in the family would have been gossiping and talking about me.
Yeah, of course. It's all about her.
So, you know, there again, yeah, it's all about her. That's the narcissism there. But anyway, so I, you know, lived with her and my stepfather, and they had 4 children. She had a couple of miscarriages prior to my oldest little brother. But anyway, she had my oldest little brother, and then she had 3 more little boys. And they all were about 2 years difference in age, and there was about 6 years difference between me and my oldest little brother. So she had a couple of miscarriages in between me and this, you know, during that 6 years. So the 4 boys actually were my half-brothers. We had the same mother, but we had, you know, a different father, but unbeknownst to me at the time. So my stepfather ended up getting transferred in the military to Japan. And the first year he was over there, he had to stay on base and was not allowed to have us come and be with him. So that whole year, that last year before we could move to Japan, and I was probably around the first grade at this time, my mother and I lived with my grandmother and this stepfather of hers that had abused her when she was a little girl. And this was also very confusing to me as a child, because I remembered her saying to me, well, he abused her. And I thought, then why in God's heaven did you leave me with that man? But then I understood why she did it. She would leave me with them, and she worked in a bar in Amarillo again. And my mother was partying and just, you know, being young, because there was only 16 years difference between us. So she was still a young woman. And she just left me there, you know, because she knew that my grandmother would take care of me, and she just was free to go and do as she pleased. Well, unbeknownst to my mother at that time, and my grandmother, is that was the beginning of when I remember the sexual abuse occurring. But in actuality, it had been occurring since I was a tiny baby in diapers. But I didn't know this until after I talked with my aunt and reconnected with her. And my aunt started telling me her side of what all occurred as I was a child growing up. And my aunt told me that when she was 13 years or 12 years old, when she got pregnant by her uncle, that at that same time, she went to my grandmother and told my grandmother that she knew that my step-grandfather had been sexually abusing me and I was a baby. And she wanted to do something about it. She wanted to go to the police, so she did. And my grandmother and my step-grandfather went to the police station. And times were very different back then. But they convinced the police that my aunt was crazy, was a liar, and didn't know what she was talking about, was just a troublemaker. And the fact that my aunt was pregnant with her uncle's child also didn't look good. So they ended up packing my aunt up and moving my aunt to a home that was run by nuns. And she had her baby, and then they adopted the baby out. But this was the first person that tried to intervene and help me as a child. So nothing was done. I was left with this man, and I had memories of all of this, of him dragging me off to the basement, dragging me to his bedroom. My grandmother would be off watching TV or out shopping or something and would leave me alone, and this man would sexually abuse me. He would stick his fingers up inside of me, and he had nasty hands, you know, dirty hands. And this caused problems for me later on when I was growing up, because I had urinary tract infection, and it was undiagnosed. Nobody knew that I had this later on, and I had it for years, because in my family, you didn't say anything or complain, because if you were sick, you could get humiliated and chastised because you were an inconvenience. It was an inconvenience to have to take you to the doctor and to deal with it. So you just learned to deal with pain. And I'd always hurt down there my whole life, so I didn't know that there was anything wrong or that this wasn't a normal thing. So anyway, my stepfather ended up sending for us. And I think I was probably about in the second grade, so I was about 7 years old. And we went to Japan, and we lived in Japan for 3 years. During that time, my mother got pregnant with my second brother. And while she was in the hospital with him, my stepfather took me to his bed and was touching me and doing things and making me touch him. And, you know, I remember everything so vividly. I know a lot of times children, when they're sexually abused, they will repress this. I think one of the things that's allowed me to be able to be as mentally healthy throughout this entire stuff is the fact that I always was cognizant of what was happening, and I never went into denial. Now, at one point, I did disassociate. And what I mean by that is when something is so horrific for a child and a child's mind cannot wrap itself around it or understand it or it's terrifying, in order for you to not have a total mental breakdown, your mind is very clever. Your mind has a way of disassociating so that you can maintain your sanity. Because the way things worked is on a daytime basis when we'd be around other people or my mother, he acted normal and I was supposed to act normal and it was like nothing had ever happened. But then at night after my mother went to bed or, you know, she wasn't home or whatever, that's when he'd molest me. So this is very confusing to children because you've got two different realities going on here. And it makes you wonder, it's like your mind, to keep from splitting, you disassociate. What I do.
And the other problem also is, and maybe you can confirm this, when children are going through sexual abuse, and I know this from myself, you know, from an experience that I had, a lot of times they're afraid to tell their mothers because their mothers will either, one, not believe them, two, blame them for the sexual abuse, not support them, and they don't get rid of the boyfriends, but they keep them there. And here you are on your own having to try to struggle through this. Did you find that to be true?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Because later on when it did come out, that's exactly kind of what happened to me. But when I disassociated, what I did is that when he'd be in my bedroom, he would, I would be there and he'd be touching me and I went out of my body. And it was like, you've heard stories where people say that if they've been in a wreck or something, they kind of can leave their body. And sometimes they actually see from above, they see the wreck and the paramedics and them, their own selves in the car, in the wreck, but they're like floating above it. Well, that's what I did when he was doing these things to me. I disassociated and I floated above and I could see me laying there and see him doing things to me, but I wasn't present in my body.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a form of disassociation. There's other forms, but that was one way that I coped with it as a child to keep from, you know, losing my mind, which is a sign of strength when people do that, when children do that especially. But this stuff went on, and then when I was living in Japan, I discovered a letter on top of the refrigerator, and it had a picture in it of a man and a woman, and it said my name and all this, and I said, well, who is this man? I asked my mother, because, see, she always had me do all the housekeeping. I took care of my little brothers. I was always to do the dishes. She would save the breakfast, lunch, and supper dishes for me, irregardless if I had homework or whatever. And I'd have the table full, the stove full, the cabinet full, the sink full. And I'd be at the sink for hours. And I had to keep the house clean. I mean, I was more or less a little maid or servant. That was my job. And, you know, of course, you didn't get any kind of allowance or anything because this was considered your part of the household, and that's how you contribute. That's your job. That's your responsibility. So I had been cleaning, and I saw this letter on top of the refrigerator, and I asked my mother about it. And I was probably, I don't know, eight and a half. And she told me, oh, that's your aunt's little girl. That letter was her dad. No, I knew better. I knew I was the only child in the family with my name. I knew they had talked about my aunt, you know, my grandmother, my mother, and I knew the children she had in their names. And I knew that was true, and I called my mother on it. And she finally admitted that, yes, that was my biological father, and that was my stepmother, and that they lived in South America. So, okay, and then I got really confused and upset because I had been using my stepfather's last name in school and everything, and all of a sudden to find this out, it was really shocking, and I was really upset because even though my stepfather had been abusive to me sexually, I didn't realize at that time that that's what he was doing to me. I didn't understand that that was sexual abuse. It was all I'd ever known, ever since I was a little child, men doing this to me. So I thought this was a normal thing, that it was just life. I had nothing to gauge it by. So I loved him. I adored him. I thought he was my daddy, and I had him on a pedestal, and he could fix my broken bicycle. He could do all these things for me, and he would stand up for me. There was times when my mom, one time I got like in her makeup, and she got furious with me, and she grabbed me by my hair, and she threw me in the shower and turned the shower on, and she smeared Vaseline all over my face and just screamed at me and cussed me and told me to stay out of her things. And, you know, all little girls get curious. And my stepfather got off work and came home, and I was in the shower, sopping wet, crying. And he came in and said, "What's going on?" And she told him, and he went in there. He said, "Oh, my God." And he, you know, said, "She's just a little girl." He said, "Why don't you take her and get her some makeup she can play with and teach her how to, you know, do these things and teach her how to curl her hair and be a mother to her?" And he soothed me. So this man was not only my abuser, he was also, in some respects, my protector. And he's the only one, he would sit with me and he taught me how to read and he'd take me on walks into the forest and he'd point out the different trees and we'd talk about the animals and nature, and he taught me a lot of things and he paid attention to me and he showed me affection. He hugged me, he kissed me, he set me on his lap. And my mother was so cold and distant. Anytime I sat next to my mom, my mother would push me away and tell me, "Get off of me and, you know, leave me alone." And I remember I wanted so hard to be close to her that I loved her scent, her smell, her perfume. And I'd smell her scarf and I just loved to be close to her. And if she was watching TV, I'd sit and I'd say, "Mom, what's that?" Because I was always a very curious, inquisitive child. And like if someone gave a child an answer, some children are fine. Oh, okay. I always wanted to delve deeper and know more. I've always been inquisitive and had a thirst for knowledge. So that bothered her. I was a pest. So anyway, there was this grooming process that went on, okay? So I ended up, when I was probably about 8 years old, they ended up moving to Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And he was in the Air Force there. There was an Air Force base there. And, you know, I was getting older and going to school and making more friends. And I met this girl. Her name was Rosalind. And, oh, they were Catholic, and there was a bunch of children in their family. And I loved Rosalind. I loved her family, her brothers and sisters. I was always wanting to go and be with them. So I'd spend the night with her as much as possible. And my mother started getting suspicious that something was going on because my stepfather got really upset. I wasn't allowed to have a lock on my door, on my bedroom door. So what I would do to protect myself when I got older to try to keep him out of my bedroom is I asked my mother if I could borrow one of the kitchen chairs. It was a little wooden kitchen chair. And she allowed me to put it in my room because I told her I wanted to have books and hang my jacket on it and things like this. What I would do at night is when she'd go to bed, I would worry that he'd come and be coming in my bedroom. And so I'd take that door and I'd shove it up underneath the door knob and brace the door so that when he would try my door, he he couldn't get it open. And I wasn't allowed to go to the bathroom and have the door shut. They wanted to know what I was doing in there. He did specifically. So, you know, there was no privacy. It was very invasive. He was very invasive. But I got to where I spent more and more time away from the home at Rosalind's house with her family. And I started seeing how her father interacted with her and her brothers and sisters. And I started realizing that was happening at my home, what my family was doing and what was happening to me was not normal, that daddies did not do that to their little girls. So I started developing this terrible sense of shame and guilt and felt like I must be bad or something was wrong with me, that I was attracting this stuff into my life continuously from these men. And I just withdrew. And my mom came to me one day because she noticed I would take off and try to stay gone as much as possible. And my stepfather started getting angry about me spending so much time at my girlfriend's house with her family. And my mom said it was like he got jealous. And he even said one time to her, well, what are they, a couple of lesbians? You know, talking about me and my friend Rosalind. But I just felt safe with her, and I felt safe with her family. That's why I wanted to be there. And they were normal and fun and loving and caring, you know. So anyway, I was wanting a healthier environment. So my mom cornered me in the kitchen one day, and she started asking me questions. So I was afraid, but I went ahead and told her. See, what my stepfather did is he would drag me off different places in the woods or, you know, under the house or this or that to molest me. And he would tell me that if I ever said anything, that my mother would end up divorcing him and that my little brothers would lose their daddy and my mother wouldn't be able to support him in all this, you know, that he was needed in the family. So I had this burden of responsibility to make sure that their marriage stayed together for my little brother's sake. It was crazy. And I also babysat a lot as I got older, and the money that I made, my mom would take it, and I didn't, you know, get money for lunch, school lunch. I just went without lunches because they were always broke. And, you know, they spent money on liquor and other things. But I would save my money to buy my own school clothes. And my mom would continuously, she found out I had money because, you know, I took care of my brothers. And the neighbors all saw that I was babysitting my brothers and did a good job. So I had a lot of babysitting jobs. I was in a lot of demand, even though I was so young. They would pay me, and I'd keep my money, and my mom would go into my room and find my money, and then she'd say, well, we're going to get evicted, or I've got the car payment due, or I've got the refrigerator payment due, or this or that. And she'd figure out some way, because she knew I would give her my money to pay the bills. It's crazy.
So tonight, we acknowledge now that you came from a very broken family, where there was a lot of abuse, a lot of confusion, and a lot of, you know, certainly, you know, as a child having to go through this emotional abuse, sexual abuse, you know, you're coming out of, you know, a household filled with abuse. And now it's time to meet somebody and get married. So let's start from there.
Well, my mom ended up sending me to live with my father in South America. Mm-hmm. And she told me before I left that he was very abusive, told me the story about him being crazy, trying to kill her with a knife and trying to burn my eyes with a cigarette. So I was scared to death to go live with my father, but I didn't have a choice because she told me that I had to make a decision that she could either prosecute my stepfather, but she really needed to stay with him because of my brother's sake. So she left a decision to me, and I didn't want my brothers to lose their father, so I made the choice to go ahead and live with my father, even though I was scared to death. So I lived with my father for a year, eighth grade, and my stepmother... Afterwards, she had been married before and had a daughter that was in three or four years older than me. She was in high school, and she was in California in a boarding school. So I ended up living with my father for a year, and then I went to boarding school to start, you know, my freshman year of high school. And the first year, it wasn't too bad, but the second year, it wasn't good. But that summer after my first year, I went back to South America because that was the deal my dad had made with her, that he'd pay for my schooling and everything in boarding school, but I had to spend summers with him. So my mom was fine with that. She didn't want me around anyway. So I went back that summer to stay with my dad, and my stepmother had to leave and go to California for my stepsister's graduation from high school. So that left me alone with my dad and my brother, my half-brother, that my father had had with my stepmother. He was probably 12 or 13, and I was about 15. Anyway, my father got drunk one night after my stepmother was gone and went crazy. And my father tried to do things to me also, my biological father. But by that time, you know, I was too smart, and I knew what was going on, and I resisted. So he got drunk one night and got really abusive and just beat me half to death and shoved me into the dresser because I wouldn't do anything with him. And the dresser knob hit me in the middle of the back, and it caused me to go unconscious because it hit my vertebrae. And so when I came to, I heard my father in the kitchen. He was fixing himself another drink because I could hear the ice clinking in the glass and the alcohol he was pouring. So I ran out the front door, and I ran in the dark and hid behind bushes. He went after me. He got in the car and was looking for me, but I ran to my eighth grade school teacher's house that I had had down there in South America, and she took me in, and I stayed with her until my stepmother came back from California, and she got my ticket and my passport, and I went back to the United States, and I went back to the boarding school, and I stayed there for a half semester, and things got really bad there because they started admitting a lot of girls into the school that came from rich families, but they were wild girls, and their parents were kind of sending them there to, it was a Catholic school, to get the nuns to kind of keep them under control, and the whole atmosphere changed, and I was just miserable and unhappy. So I had been talking to my mom, and my mom said my stepfather went back to Vietnam. So she allowed me to come home because he was in Vietnam for 3 years, and she needed a babysitter and somebody to clean house again. So I came back home, took care of my little brothers. And, you know, she ran the bars and did her thing. But anyway, that went on until the middle of my senior year of high school. And then my stepfather came back and they got transferred to Lubbock. And I went for the beginning of my senior high school to live with my mom and my stepfather once again in Lubbock, Texas. And then he started doing things, you know, coming on to me, saying suggestive things. And I went to my mom and told her. And she said, well, now I'm in the middle of my senior year of high school, right? I hadn't even graduated high school. And she said, well, it's like this. I was younger than you when I was out on my own. She said, you just got to get out. She was going to kick me out in the street. And I had been dating a boy. And so my mom said, well, your only other option, you can get married. So I called him on the phone, and he married me. So I married him, and I finished high school, I graduated, and then he and I were married 3 years, and he was very abusive physically. We were so young, and he had a lot of hobbies. He had hot rods, and he spent a lot of money on hot rods to the point where we didn't have money to eat, and we'd fight, and he'd just beat me up because he knew I didn't have any place to go. So I ended up divorcing him, and then I – stayed single for a couple years, and then I met another man. I dated a couple guys in between there. They were physically abusive. They were alcoholics. See, I had this pattern where I was falling into this stuff because I was this little lost soul running around looking for love, looking for acceptance, looking for security, and I just was preyed upon by men that could see my desperation and my neediness. So I met my husband, and I had made a promise to myself after all of this. I was so sick, Bonnie, of all the physical abuse. I knew my poor body couldn't take it any longer. So I thought, if I can meet somebody that will give me some security, that's decent, that, you know, be good to me, that they won't beat me, I'll be satisfied and I'll be happy and I'll try to make a good wife and a good life with this person. Well, I met this man and I married him, and I was married to him. We were together 42 years. And unbeknownst to me, for the first part of our marriage, I consoled myself and told myself things were okay. You know, it was better than I'd ever had. I just lived in denial because it was better than I had ever known. He didn't beat me, and I felt like that was a big accomplishment towards becoming mentally healthier by not being beat up by the man I was with or anybody.
Exactly.
So ended up, though,
it's easy to mistake that. You know, when you're coming from such an abusive situation and somebody's kinder to you, it's easy
right.
to ignore, even if there are red flags, you still feel like you're in better condition than you were in before. And
but,
you know,
he had a lot of issues. He had alcohol problems and drug problems and everything. But I felt like that once we got married, that he would settle down, he'd grow up. I thought part of that was just, you know, his problems because he was young and immature. And he had told me that before we got married, that he had had an experience when he was a young boy, when he was probably about 12 or 13 years old, with a neighborhood older boy, that this boy had gotten him drunk, and they had experimented with each other sexually. And I asked him, I said, well, are you telling me this because you're trying to tell me that you're gay? And he denied it. You know, oh, no, no. He said, I just wanted to, you know, let you know that this happened and I didn't like it. It's not my thing. And I just wanted you to know in case any of this ever came out in our lives. I wanted to be transparent with you. And I thought, well, okay, you know, coming from my background, there was all kinds of craziness. And I thought, well, you know, he's not at fault any more than I was at fault. He was abused like I was abused. So I just more or less took his word for it. Well, he died about 3 years ago, and after he died, there were a lot of things that came out. I had always been very lonely in my marriage. He'd always seemed kind of distant and cold. I was constantly catching him in lies and things that he was doing and knew he was manipulating. He had some health problems where he needed a transplant, an organ transplant, and he had gone overseas to an Asian country, and he got involved with Asian prostitutes. And all this stuff came out after he got back, and he confessed it to me, and, you know, we had a lot of problems with it. But because I knew he was physically ill, I felt like that once he got the organ transplant, he might get better. His mind would clear up because the kind of issues he had caused them to build up in his blood and caused encephalopathy. So I was looking at this always from a logical point of view. But what happened is his company ended up moving him out of state. And since he was so close to retirement, I decided to stay in our home because it was paid for. And I stayed here, and he was only supposed to be down there for a few years, and he got an apartment. Well, he'd come back every couple of months for a week or so and visit me. And at one point, you know, he said, well, I'm about ready to retire. I think I'm going to put in for retirement. And I said, oh, great. But I always knew, you know, that I didn't quite feel like I ever believed him because of his lies and the things he had done through the years. But I never had any evidence of anything other than the time he had been with the prostitutes in Asia. So there were times I'd call him. He wouldn't be available. He'd tell me, well, my phone battery is dead or the reception was bad in the apartment. There's a lot of trees around here, this and that. He always came up with such good excuses. After he passed away, I had to go down to his apartment and clean his apartment out and move everything back that was in his apartment. Bonnie, I was never so shocked in my life. This man had been living a double life for I don't know how long. I know at least as long as he was down there. Mm-hmm. I found all kinds of sexual toys and lubricants and, you know, evidence that he had been going to sex clubs of all kinds, and he was doing anal sex, and I was just totally blown away and in such shock and confusion and didn't understand any of it. There were things there that I didn't even know what it was. I had to Google it and do research to even understand what it was and how people even used it. It was unbelievable. And I started realizing that this man that I had been with all these years, I had no idea who he really was.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing. You know, the deceit that you go through and how the shock value of that when you have to find out why all these years, the problems that were there. Right?
Right. And, you know, when I reflect back on everything, I think about my childhood and how I was conditioned and groomed to be a caretaker. And I was, you know, always made to accept the unacceptable and tolerate things that should have never been tolerated. I more or less, how could I have not entered into anything else? As the years went on and I started getting an education and started learning about psychology and dealing with children and sexual abuse, I started seeing things in my marriage. And I knew my husband had issues and problems. And I went to a marriage counselor with him after he came back from Asia. And the marriage counselor told me that he was a narcissist. But she didn't even know that he was, you know, gay or participating in these gay activities. She didn't. That didn't even come out with her. But she tried to get me to leave him. And at the time, I wanted to leave him. But I told her if I leave him, he will not be able to get an organ transplant. And I could not leave him and allow him to die. A lot of us women, we are very loyal. And it's hard because you have love sometimes for these men in spite of all this horrific things, but yet you hate the things they're doing. It throws women in such a state of emotional and mental confusion. It takes a long time to work yourself through all this and to start healing.
Yes, and especially when you're coming out of such an abusive household to start with. First, you have to get past that abuse. To get past this abuse.
Yeah, it takes years of, you know, introspective thought process to try to figure this stuff out and therapy. And, you know, I think there's always going to be some residual things that occur. Like, even to this day, I feel like I've dealt with it all fairly well. I'm fairly mentally healthy. I mean, I've always been complimented by all the psychiatrists, everyone I worked with, that, you know, I was mentally healthy. And I think I've come out of it, you know, pretty whole. But there are things that occur, and these are things, even though you deal with it all on a conscious level, subconsciously, these are remnants of the abuse that's left over. Things such as panic attacks when you're triggered and night terrors. You know, there have been times I was sound asleep and just woke up crying, bawling, hysterically bawling. You know, and nightmares and things, these things are things on a subconscious level. It's because you end up with complex post-traumatic stress. And there's evidence that children that have gone through this type of thing, and it gets worse when it's prolonged and intense and repetitive. It causes even more damage, and that's when it becomes complex post-traumatic stress. So it's an ongoing healing process that I will probably live with till the day I die. That I have.
And for me, even more, you know, more suspicious of people, you know, who try to get into our group. You know, I have to talk to every single one of them because a lot of people ask, and I know they're not legit. But, you know, we're used to being caretakers, like you say, and always taking care of everyone. And in the past, that worked for me. It doesn't anymore. You know, I've learned one thing after all these years of setting boundaries. You know, you can still be generous with your time, but you have to have boundaries so that you're not overrun. And that's the problem. Your husband passed away how long ago?
It was 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
3 years ago.
Cleaning out his apartment, that's when you found all the sexual paraphernalia, right?
Oh, yes. I had no idea that he was doing all that stuff until I walked in that apartment. And I'm telling you, it was shocking. Shocking, shocking. I look back on it now and I'm going, oh, my goodness. But, you know, one thing, I do try to look at the bright side of everything, Bonnie. I feel like so much for him. If I hadn't found these things out, I probably would have grieved myself endlessly for a long time. And knowing this, I feel a sense of release from that because it lets me stand back and have a different perspective on it, that this man was so unhealthy for me that I'm really... For the first time in my life, I have freedom now, and I am the person that can change my destiny. And there's something that I have that I've never had my entire life, and that is peace of mind and security. Because I know that unless I invite this craziness in, I don't have to live that way anymore. I'm free.
And you've been a really great sense of support for many of our women in the group, Janae. You know, I really appreciate that because, you know, you're going through your own recovery and yet you're always there for everybody because you are that kind of caretaker person. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, so I'm going to have to impose on you to come back again so we can
finish some
of these issues in a couple of weeks. And because there's a lot of things that we didn't have a chance to talk about. And, you know, many times there's some insight on that for women, too. So, not, you know, in the next
I can contribute to help anybody else, because, honestly, it is a passion of mine to try to help women and children that, you know, hopefully at some point our society will become educated and we'll become non-tolerant of this, and the world will be a better place for everyone. And
I think also that people are so spread out throughout this country and throughout the world that you don't realize a lot of times what other cultures are about and what other neighborhoods are about, how people get away with this kind of stuff, how it's acceptable in some communities. So when you come back, we'll be talking about that. So
Alrighty,
I really feel bad that we're being cut off in a couple seconds, but thank you so much for joining us tonight. We'll have you back here in a few weeks. And we'll continue this conversation. And to all our listeners, thank you for joining us. You're welcome, Janae. I love you, and I hope to talk to you again very soon. All right, all of our listeners, have a happy night. Good night now.
Good night.